Welcome to AZMCast, the Competitive Emergency Medicine Podcast. Our goal on AZMCast is to demonstrate the knowledge, skills, and the approach to help you, the listener, be a top-notch emergency provider. Our panel of emergency specialists will go head-to-head as they navigate a case from the ring down to the workup to the dispo. Panelists will be awarded points for their quick wit, prioritization of tasks, and their clinical application of evidence-based medicine. However, they will lose points for weak arguments that rely on experience-based medicine and the use of banned, unhelpful jargon like gestalt or high index of suspicion, or just because I feel like it. The panelists with the most points at the end of each episode will have free rein during the art of EM to rant about whatever aspect of EM is near and dear to their hearts at that given moment. We encourage you, the listener, to pause the podcast at each segment and consider your own approach before going on with the discussion. And our hope is that you will develop a prioritized, evidence-based approach to emergency medicine that will carry you into your next shift. Although we're going to continue in the debate style, it's going to be different from our typical points and panelists. This month, we're going to feature Dr. Garrett Pacheco from the Department of Emergency Medicine and Dr. Adam Nelson from the Department of Surgery and the Division of Trauma. They are going to be doing an evidence-based debate on the PAN scan, that head-to-toe tube of truth, look for the most minuscule and the most major of injuries that could be found on whoever is traumatized coming through the emergency department. A priori, Dr. Pacheco opted to take the pro-PAN scan stance, and Dr. Nelson opted to take the anti-PAN scan stance. And they present a good amount of evidence, a good amount of argument, and a really frank discussion on some of the things that come up in the trauma bay every single day about whether or not to PAN scan. Now, I will say that this was all put on for show, and so the positions that are presented here may not actually represent what Dr. Nelson and Dr. Pacheco think in their own clinical practice, but it is a wonderful, concise synopsis of the evidence behind whether or not to PAN scan. I think they both did an incredible job, and it's my pleasure to get to showcase them on this month's episode of AZMCast. All right, welcome everyone. I think most everyone can hear. So my name is Aaron Leach, and I'm in emergency medicine. It's a full house today because we're bringing back trauma conference. So we've got trauma surgery here. We've got emergency medicine. We're going to talk about some of the things that we run into a lot in the trauma bay. And we have, I'm going to show you the format real quick. We have some excellent work and preparation that were done by Dr. Garrett Pacheco and Dr. Adam Nelson, who have done an awesome job. They put a lot of work into this. All right, so we're going to present the case. I'm going to briefly talk about the team dynamics. This is going to be a debate style discussion. It's not going to be a true debate. They're going to be presenting points and counterpoints of things that will often come up. There are reasons to, reasons not to. And the thing that we're going to keep going back to over and over and over is that this requires good discussion and teamwork and collaboration, trying to hear the other person out and what they're thinking, okay? In order for this to work, we're going to change the scenario a couple times because that's what happens in the middle of our workup. The scenario can change. So this is scenario number one. This is a 25-year-old male who's involved in an MVC, was about 37 miles an hour, unknown loss of consciousness, but has some facial trauma. He is sober. He is alert. He's cooperative. Vital signs are here. He's got a forehead hematoma, swollen eye. This is a pretty typical MVC that we'll probably see on Friday. Airways patent, good breath sounds, GCS of 15. You can see his exposure right here. He's got a temporal lack, periorbital edema, frontal hematoma, abrasions. Everything else looks to be normal. The question that we're going to go over today, and we're going to spend the rest of this time on, is do we PAN scan this patient or not? This comes up, would you say, on a daily basis we have this question, right? Do we PAN this, at least a daily basis, do we PAN scan this patient or not? And this is a question that is going to come up a lot. And Dr. Nelson and Dr. Pacheco have opted on their own to take these sides. Dr. Nelson is going to maintain the position that these patients we present do not need a PAN scan. That's not to say they don't need any scans, but they don't need a PAN scan. Dr. Pacheco is going to take the point that no, all of them need a PAN scan. Okay? I don't know what's so funny, but yeah, no, I do. Okay, so I'm going to hand this over to them now, and I'm going to let them go.
So I think just some definitions are in order of what a PAN scan actually is. It can be institutional dependent, you know, but overall, what we're referring to most of today is that it's two separate scans, a non-enhanced CT of the head as well as a cervical spine, followed by an enhanced CT of the chest, abdomen, pelvis, which gives us the ability to reconstruct both thoracic and lumbar spine images. Some institutions actually have a protocol where they have an arterial phase of the head and neck where they can get a CTA to assess for cerebral vascular injuries. So the big point that I want to make for this particular patient that was in a MVC at 37 miles per hour, has obvious signs of head and neck injury, as well as right upper extremity injury, is my argument is to perform a whole body CT. And that really relates to why trauma overall is a high stakes disease. These patients are at least 45 years and up, trauma is the leading cause of mortality. And what ATLS, the algorithmic approach to addressing these patients, is to perform your exam as part of your survey and performing your adjuncts, which is plain films of the chest, pelvis, FAST exam, and then deciding on selective CT imaging following that. I think that we all know that there are significant limitations to that approach, particularly the chest plain films. Overall, there's significant limitations with identifying occult pneumothoraces by the trauma team in the resuscitation room. We might as well flip a coin for a supine chest film of identifying an occult pneumothorax. And then some will say, well, what are the clinical significance of those findings? There's a really well-done study, a prospective study done in 2015, Annals of Emergency Medicine, that included over 5,000 patients, and they found occult injuries in 71% of patients that had thoracic injuries after CT was done before a preceding chest film. So chest film was done, CT followed, 71% of those patients had occult injuries. Occult injuries was defined as a pneumothorax, a hemothorax, a sternal fracture or two or more rib fractures, pulmonary contusion, thoracic or scapular fractures, major vessel injury or diaphragm injury. So 46% of those patients had a normal preceding chest x-ray. The chest x-ray is very limited in assessing patients. Pelvic films in hematically stable patients have been shown to have high cost and limited utility. So the sensitivity is somewhere around 50 to 70% for all pelvic fractures. So in a hematically stable patient like this, may not necessarily be that helpful. FAST exam has significant limitations with solid abdominal organ injury and retroperitoneal injuries. There's a really early study done in like 2003 that found some significant findings in a single center where 22 patients had at least false negatives. A significant amount of those patients actually went in to require operative intervention. Even the false or the true negatives, a significant amount of those patients had intra-abdominal injury without hemoperitoneum and also had retroperitoneal injuries. So if I'm worried about this high stakes disease, I need the most accurate way to identify injuries so that way I can come up with my therapeutic plan. And then a CT. CT is just a better test. It has 90% sensitivity and specificity for identifying hemoperitoneum or any sort of traumatic hepatic lesions or solid abdominal organ injury. And it outperforms this algorithmic approach of the conventional radiography of exam, which I will get to, has significant limitations, as well as the plain films of the chest and pelvis and FAST exam. So overall, full body CT leads to earlier diagnosis, and with that, earlier treatment, decreased ED length of stay, decreased hospitalization length of stay, and likely fewer missed injuries. So whole body CT in earlier studies demonstrated a mortality benefit. This was a study done in 2003 in Lancet, or 2009 in Lancet, and it looked at a large German trauma society registry that included over 9,000 patients, and they looked for a mortality benefit compared to predictive mortality based off injury severity scores. So we looked at TRIS, the trauma injury severity score, as well as the revised injury severity classification, which can, you know, when they're higher, actually predict mortality. So they found that absolute mortality was reduced compared to those predictive mortalities based off TRIS and based off risk. They also showed that through logistic regression analysis that independent of all these different confounders, such as the level of the trauma center or the time of year or what equipment was available, whole body CT was an independent predictor for survival. So on top of that, in 2013, they did an additional study that found, looked at over 16,000 patients. 9,000 of those patients received whole body CT, and they showed an absolute mortality reduction with the use of whole body CT. And not only so they did they show it in hemodynamically stable patients, they now showed it in patients that were hemodynamically unstable. So these are much sicker patients. They have higher injury severity scores. So I know that CT is better than conventional methods of identifying injuries. I know that whole body CT provides a mortality benefit, but this study I think is also pretty beneficial to my argument of why I want to CT this young patient that's sober, that's evaluable. This was done at USC in 2006. They looked at 1,000 patients, 529 of those patients were evaluable. They had no signs of chest or abdominal injury. They basically had a negative abdominal exam. So a significant portion of those patients had clinically significant CT findings. Almost 3.5% of them had abnormal head CTs. 5% of them had abnormal cervical spines. 19% of, based off chest imaging, had thoracic injuries. And 7% of them had abdominal injuries. 19% of them had a change in their treatment plan based off CT findings. So these were patients that were evaluable that had no evidence of chest or abdominal injury, that had clinically significant injuries that would require some sort of intervention. So for my patient, again, even though they, you know, an MBC of about 37 miles per hour, which this study included as a mechanism alone, MBC greater than 35 miles per hour, I would pursue a whole body CT for this particular patient.
So there's no doubt that CT scans are both sensitive and fast for detecting injuries in trauma patients. However, they aren't free. We all know that there's an added cost to patient and healthcare system when unnecessary tests are done. Additionally, CT scans increase the patient exposure to radiation and increase the number of incidental findings such as lung and thyroid nodules, which require additional workup, which is all just added anxiety and cost to the patient. So the question is whole body CT for trauma patients better than a selective approach where we choose to scan, where we choose what to scan based on physiology and exam findings? One way to try and answer this question is to study if there's a mortality benefit when comparing the two approaches. And as it turns out, and as Dr. Pacheco has shown you, there are several studies which suggest that mortality is indeed improved with whole body CT. However, we have to point out that these studies have some serious limitations. They are all mostly retrospective, observational, and suffer from a number of biases and confounders. And additionally, and perhaps the biggest limitation of all these observational studies is that they don't directly compare mortality between whole body CT in the between the whole body CT and selective imaging groups, but instead focus on the difference between measured mortality and the mortality as predicted by trauma scoring systems. Now, let me explain why this matters. So injury severity score, or ISS as an example, is one of several trauma scoring systems that's used to calculate predicted mortality. Now, ISS divides the body into six regions, and injuries are assigned a numerical score based on their severity using ICD-10 codes, which then goes into a formula to determine ISS and can then be used to come up with the predicted mortality. So if you have a bunch of insignificant injuries like hematomas or transverse process fractures that get picked up on a PAN scan, you could then see how predicted mortality would be inflated, and therefore you would show an artificial benefit in terms of mortality reduction with whole body CT, which is again, a big potential problem of the observational studies that have been presented so far. However, there is some relatively high quality data. Now, in 2016, a prospective multi-center randomized controlled trial called REACT-2 was published comparing whole body CT to selective imaging approaches. Included patients met one of the following criteria. They had abnormal physiology based on vital signs, GCS, or an estimated blood loss. They had clinical suspicion of having a severe injury such as long bone fractures, flail chest or pelvic fracture, or they had a severe mechanism of injury, such as a fall greater than 10 feet, or ejection from a vehicle, or bodily entrapment. Now, this study included nearly 1,100 patients across five different hospitals, all of which were level one trauma centers. Participants were randomized either to receive immediate whole body CT or trauma PAN scan without prior conventional imaging. Now, mind you that life-saving interventions such as intubation were obviously performed first, or they received selective imaging, which consisted of a chest x-ray, pelvic x-ray, and FAST, during the primary survey, and then they got CT imaging based on a set of predefined criteria for each body region. For example, a CT sign, a seatbelt sign across the abdomen would get you a CT of the abdomen. In terms of outcomes, there was no difference in in-hospital mortality, which was their primary outcome, being about 15% in both groups. Additionally, this was broken down into 24-hour and 30-day mortalities, and again, no difference. In terms of secondary outcomes, the whole body CT group had significantly higher radiation exposure. The whole body CT group also had decreased time to diagnosis and time to imaging completion. There was no difference in cost between the two groups and no difference in rate of missed injuries from a tertiary survey, which was about 10% in both groups. Note that about 50% of patients in the selective group met criteria to have everything scanned in a sequential fashion. Essentially, they underwent a whole body CT. But because this was an intention to treat study, they stayed in the selective group for analysis. And while this may appear as a flaw in the study, it also means that 50% of the control patients, so about 250 people, avoided unnecessary CT scans using the selective methodology. So let's look back at our patient from this first scenario. He's tachycardic, but otherwise stable. He's normotensive. His exam really just shows evidence of head, facial, and upper extremity injury. His mechanism is a low-speed MVC, and he's sober, examinable, and has a GCS of 15. He does meet REACT2 criteria based on his tachycardia, and so based on what we've learned, we could say that his mortality is going to be the same with a whole-body CT versus a selective approach. And so for this patient, one can make an argument that he just could get a thorough physical exam with labs, some conventional imaging, chest x-ray, pelvic x-ray, and a fast exam. His cervical spine should be examined. And if non-tender and he meets Nexus criteria, could be cleared clinically. And then a selective approach could be used to his CT imaging, which for him might include head and a max space scan. And then decisions about further imaging might be made based on the results of his initial evaluation and imaging.
So my rebuttal to this is that with these initially observational studies that did show a mortality benefit, there's been at least three different systematic reviews and meta-analysis that have really tried to take out some of those confounding variables. And one study by Gokudo et al. Took about seven of those studies that seemed to be matched fairly well and showed a full analysis where overall they did show a mortality benefit. They did show reduced time in the emergency department, which actually affected clinical outcomes. So Surinden and Yang et al. Showed similar things in 2014 as well. So as Dr. Nelson mentioned, some issues that I find with REACT2, at least 36% of patients in the selective CT group had injury severity scores less than 16. So if you look at all of these original studies, the injury severity scores, all of them, one of the inclusion criteria was that it needed to at least be greater than 16. So arguably, the patients in the selective CT imaging group are not as ill. I mean, that obviously could be inflated because the patients in the whole body CT group are identifying more injuries, but that's still 36% of injury or 36% of patients that have lower injury severity scores. I think, as Dr. Nelson mentioned, another flaw is that 46% of the patients in the selective CT imaging group basically had the equivalent of a whole body CT. So just slightly less than half of those patients were basically whole body CT patients during the entire hospital admission. So comparing, trying to find a mortality benefit and comparing oranges to like half oranges, that's going to be difficult. So I would still pursue, in this particular patient, you know, knowing that this, that they are valuable, and even though they had a normal exam, that they have a 19% risk of even wanting to change their treatment plan based off findings from their CT scan, I would still pursue a whole body CT for this particular patient.
EMS report number two. So this is a change in the scenario. So now we have a 25-year-old male who is found down behind a bar. Unknown assault, but he has evidence of facial trauma. No one really knows what happened to him. He is clearly intoxicated, but he's alert and he'll cooperate with you. He's a very happy drunk. Vital signs remain the same. Physical exam remains the same. Primary and secondary survey remains the same, except for a GCS of 14 because he's intoxicated and slurring. Pan scan or no pan scan?
So for this gentleman, he's similar to the first patient from a vital sign and finding standpoint. The main difference here is that he's found down and he's intoxicated, although cooperative. Now, there certainly are some compelling reasons to PANSCAN this patient. However, for this guy, I want to present a few potential downsides to obtaining full body CT for trauma patients. Number one, that's the cost to patients. And number two is radiation exposure. Now, I think it's important to understand that in the US healthcare system, it's plagued by unnecessary medical testing and treatment. One analysis from the Washington State Health Alliance called First Do No Harm examined medical insurance claims for commonly ordered tests and treatments and found that over a single year, 600,000 patients received unnecessary tests or treatments, a collective cost of $282 million. Now, one third of the money spent comprised unnecessary care. And as an example, 85% of pre-op labs to prep healthy patients for low-risk surgery were unnecessary at a cost of $86 million. And 75% of annual cervical cancer screenings were performed on patients who'd already had an adequate screening before the recommended five-year screening period had elapsed at a cost of $19 million. And this is occurring in the setting of increased medical debt, especially with the pandemic, where many Americans have lost their insurance benefits due to unemployment. In the US, it's currently estimated that 20 million people have medical debt, with a whopping $45 billion in collections at this point. And this is only getting worse, with the yearly increase in medical debt being at a 3% per year increase pre-pandemic, which is now more than doubled to 7% per year yearly increase. Hospitalizations account for one quarter of all medical debt. 22% of debt is accounted for by diagnostics, and that's primarily imaging, and 19% of debt is accounted for by emergency room visits. Another potential downside to whole body CT is an increase in radiation exposure. Now, the exact relationship between radiation and malignancy risk is controversial. However, the most widely accepted model is called the linear no threshold model. This model is based on extrapolation from atomic bomb survivors and assumes that any radiation exposure increases cancer risk in a linear dose-dependent fashion. And you can see on the table here that whole body CT delivers a sizable amount of radiation compared to other more selective examinations. Now, there is increasing consensus that the risk of developing cancer from diagnostic imaging is real. However, that risk is small to individual patients. Here are a few examples of risk estimates that have been made at this point. One is that 1 in 1,000 people exposed to 10 millisieverts will develop cancer due to that single exposure. 1 in 500 persons will develop cancer from an abdominal CT if that study is performed at the age of 20. And another is that a screening whole body CT adds an additional 0.08% attributable risk of cancer mortality over the patient's lifetime. Now back to our patient. One could argue that, again, he undergo a thorough physical exam with a set of labs, chest, pelvis, and fast exam. He should probably get his head and face scanned. And since he can't be cleared by Nexus due to his intoxication, that should also include a cervical spine. And then one could argue that he be observed and then re-examined when he's more sober. And then further imaging could be based on the results of his initial evaluation during and after observation.
All right. So from my point of view, I think this patient, I think it would be a detriment to basically delay their evaluation. I mean, think about this. We do this hopefully not all the time, but a patient gets moved to trauma floor to room 34. All of a sudden, they're not being watched as closely. All of a sudden, that patient could be harboring a dangerous condition that you're waiting 6 hours for them to metabolize their alcohol for, and potentially miss or delay diagnosis. But we know that identifying injuries early on will lead to earlier treatment and likely better outcomes. So, so again, trauma is a time-sensitive disease. So this study was done in 2007 by Wenninger et al. And it looked at patients that had undergone whole body CT, and it looked primarily at the importance of diagnostic intervals as far as having a definitive diagnosis or having how long these patients were in the emergency department or in the hospital and kind of what were their outcomes. So they found that patients that had whole body CT led to faster diagnosis and more accurate diagnosis. So they would identify injuries accurately within 12 minutes in the whole body CT group, within 40 minutes, and not as accurately, somewhere in the range of 70% for definitive diagnosis in the selective imaging group. So
So again, that's a pretty big issue. If we can't identify the disease early, we could potentially be missing out on providing appropriate treatment and appropriate therapy. They also found that time in the emergency department, which I think you guys all know right now, is horrendous. So we have lobbies full of 20 to 40 people. You have these patients that are being allowed to metabolize that are dangerous because they are active patients. We're busy seeing new patients. You know, they're not getting the same attention that they deserve. These particular patients in this study, if they had a whole body CT, they were trying to disposition from the emergency department with 70 minutes, or when if they had a selective imaging, it's greater than 104 minutes. So that alone, I think, is a really strong argument that we need to evaluate these patients early on. Also, there are studies done in the 90s by Livingston where they found that if patients had a negative head CT or a negative abdominal CT, they're done. The patient can be dispositioned to home. They don't need to have a prolonged stay in the emergency department. They don't need to be staying overnight in the hospital. So again, that will be a time saver for us. These patients in this Wenninger study, they had overall less invasive ventilation. They had less ICU days and less hospital days, which they attributed to earlier diagnosis and earlier effective treatment for these patients. So REACT2, the one thing that I did like about REACT2 is that it did find a time benefit. These patients did have less time for diagnosis as far as their imaging time, and they had a faster definitive diagnosis. I think in our busy level one trauma center, it's critical that we are able to evaluate these patients fast and efficiently. So as far as healthcare or health-related costs related to whole body CT imaging, there's really limited data specifically for whole body CT in the literature. And if you really want to do an effective cost analysis, you not only have to look at health-related issues, you also have to look at the cost related to medical legal-related issues for missed or delayed diagnosis if that cost analysis were to take place. So one study that was done in the Journal of Trauma Acute Care Surgery in 2014 was this hypothetical analysis where they specifically took 30-year-old males that were involved with low-speed MDCs, and they specifically were less severely injured. Because that's the argument. I feel like you kind of got the sense. Really sick patients, OICT may be reasonable. But as far as these less severely injured patients getting stuck with a large hospital bill, the argument is, well, I don't want to increase their costs during the stay. So this hypothetical study looked at these less severely injured patients. It really found no increase in their medical costs during the hospital stay and their projected medical costs over time. This worked for 30-year-old males. So $15,000 versus $17,000 for selective CT imaging. And then REACT2, which is, again, the only randomized controlled trial that we have on the topic, really didn't show any difference in cost between the whole body CT group, which about 25,000 euros compared to about 27,000 euros in the selective CT imaging group. And as far as cost of radiation, as far as, you know, we all are at cognizant of this, we're all worried about this. We know by that linear dose threshold model that as we increase radiation exposure, we increase the patient's risk for potential malignant lethal malignancy. So if you look at REACT2 though, and you look at comparing whole body CT versus selective CT imaging, there was a statistical difference between whole body CT and selective CT imaging. 20.9 millisieverts, which I saw you added to 21. Go 0.3 millisieverts. Clinical significance of that, I don't know what to do with that. So I'm not really sure what to make of that. As far as risk of cancer mortality for a 45-year-old patient, you know, a study done in radiology in 2004 looked at patients that received a single whole body CT, and they found that their risk of developing a lethal malignancy was modest at 0.08%. So that's one in 1,250 patients. So the same lead author for the REACT2 trial looked at a study in emergency radiology in 2013, and they compared a protocol that used conventional radiography, just because they didn't have their CTs available, to when they instituted a total body CT protocol where all patients got them at a different time period. And they looked at effective radiation dose for the conventional radiography group versus the whole body CT group. And overall, there was no difference between it. So selective CT imaging doesn't necessarily equal less radiation dose. And then this last study I thought was really interesting. So they found that when they performed one whole body CT, the patient actually got less radiation overall in the total hospital period because the other patients in the selected group had additional imaging studies throughout their hospitalization. They actually found a 24% reduction if the patient had received a whole body CT from the initial evaluation.
So I think, you know, with considering that this patient, I don't want to delay their evaluation because I could potentially miss dangerous actionable injuries that I need to do something about. And then overall, the cost not being significantly different, and then the radiation exposure, again, being modest, I'm going to treat the patient in front of me. I think that this patient would benefit most from a whole body CT. So we're trying to identify those injuries early on.
What can I say? I like whole numbers. So I'm going to argue with you a little bit about some of the things you brought up. So in terms of costs, the REACT2 trial, again, had nearly 50% of patients in the control group who essentially received a whole body CT. And since, again, this was intention to treat, they were left there. So this likely skews the cost and radiation dose comparison between the two groups. And so the cost and radiation dose for these patients who got less body part scanned is probably lower than what was published in the study. Now, is it clinically significant? I don't know. In terms of radiation, while the cancer risk estimates are relatively small for individuals, you have to think of this on a population-based level. So if the true cancer risk estimate is 1 in 500 or 1 in 1,000 people, and you scan that number of people, which we do here all the time, one of them is getting cancer, right? And so that's just important to remember. And again, I think that we, as a healthcare providers, have a duty to avoid unnecessary testing whenever possible.
And for the third and final scenario, now we're out of the 20-year-old. This is the 65-year-old male found down behind a bar. And this case is otherwise exactly the same as the last one. Unknown assault, evidence of facial trauma, clearly intoxicated. GCS of 14 due to his intoxication. Think about what you would do for this patient as Dr. Pacheco takes over.
So now I want to make an emphasis on the fact that this patient is intoxicated or altered. I tried to avoid that last time. I alluded to it a little bit, but overall, patients that have a depressed level of consciousness, what do you rely on in that case? You want to be able to rely on your exam, but if you don't have that because they're intoxicated, they're brain injured, you basically lost that ability to appropriately assess that patient. So this patient is intoxicated, and the fact that they're intoxicated and have that depressed level of consciousness, they're at higher risk for multi-region injury just from the beginning. On top of that, this patient is 65 years old. So what do we know? Patients, both anatomically and physiologically, become more frail as they get older. They're at higher risk for, they're subjective to higher risk for injury, especially with even lower mechanisms of trauma. So this is kind of illustrated by some of our prediction rules that we use. So Canadian C-spine rules, Nexus. The Nexus looked at a sub-analysis of patients 65 years and older, and they found that the prediction rule failed in those particular circumstances. That's why Canadian C-spine doesn't even include patients off older than 65, just from the very beginning of the branch point, even if they're considered low test probability or moderate test probability. You can't really use that patient population to determine if they don't need imaging of their cervical spine. That probably translates to both thoracic and abdominal injuries as well. This particular study, the American Journal of Surgery in 2003, did a liberal scanning kind of protocol where they found some unexpected findings in 38% of patients. These patients had closed injuries, so they were considered unevaluable. So 38%, 26% of those actually led to some sort of change in the management of that patient. Some of them actually but got hospitalized because of the findings. Some of them actually, a big portion of them actually got upgraded from the general ward to the ICU. A significant amount of them actually went for angiography or chest thoracostomy or intubation, and a lesser amount actually went to the operating room for an actual intervention. And a finding that was not actually picked up on conventional radiography or physical examination. So 37%, I think this is what's terrifying to me, and I hate to say it, but 37% of those patients that had an abnormal CT finding had normal physical exam. So this elderly patient, this intoxicated patient, even if they don't have any evidence of chest or abdominal injury, I would pursue a whole body CT for them.
All right. So I'm certainly going to acknowledge that there are some very compelling reasons to obtain liberal imaging in this patient. However, I also want to discuss yet another potential downside to whole body CT, which is an increase in incidental radiographic findings, which really, as of right now, we have no idea how important they are clinically and down the road and what happens to people who have these findings. Rates of incidental findings vary, but are published to be higher with whole body CT compared to a selective approach. And as one might expect with our elderly patient in this scenario, the incidences of these findings certainly varies with age, increases with age. And they're most commonly found in the chest and abdomen, primarily lung and liver lesions. 48 to 68% of incidental findings require additional imaging workup prior per radiology guidelines, which generates additional cost and anxiety for patients and the potential for breaks in follow-up care. And along those lines, multiple series have shown that overall there is relatively poor communication of incidental findings between trauma providers and trauma teams and trauma patients, which certainly has numerous medical legal implications. Unfortunately, it is not well documented what proportion of these findings end up being clinically significant and how they're managed.
So, I mean, we all experience this where we have that incidental finding, that pulmonary knockout, and ultimately we just need to do a better job of communicating to the patient that it's present, that it requires some sort of follow-up. But as Dr. Nelson said, overall, what the variability in incidental findings and selective imaging versus whole body CT, with really no known clinical significance, if any of those are actionable pathology that would require further follow-up, I just think that there's a lot of gray there. And I think that, again, looking at this patient that has potential severe injury, dangerous injury, that one of the benefits of performing a whole body CT outweighs that negative aspect of potentially finding some incidental findings. And I think, in general, looking at the use of liberal CT and unexpected findings that actually end up becoming clinically significant is important. So this was a study that was done that, again, looked at patients that had one or more body part basically scanned, and they found that 38% of them had abnormal findings. 26% of those patients, positive or negative, had a change in their treatment plan. So again, looking at my individual patient, knowing that the benefits of potentially identifying injuries that would change my management for that patient, I would pursue a whole body CT. Again, another follow-up study was 74% of patients had one or more diagnoses that were demonstrated by chest or abdominal CT that were not picked up with conventional radiography or physical exam. That's also huge. A big portion of those patients had required a change in their management plan. And we also argue a lot about, you know, the utility of the chest CT, but I hope I've shown you with that study from the Annals of Emergency Medicine, the study out of USC, where they had 19% of patients that have thoracic injuries that are clinically significant. This study as well, 33% of chest injuries were found on chest CT that were not found otherwise. I think that the utility of the whole body CT scan is appropriate in this intoxicated patient. And then just going back to that original study from USC, where they had 1,000 patients that had undergone whole body CT, 408 of them were like intoxicated or had depressed level consciousness that were non-evaluable, and where 592 of them were actually scanned just by mechanism alone. So in that patient population, they had normal initial abdominal exams, normal chest and abdominal, no external signs of chest and abdominal injury. 7% of them had abdominal CT findings, and 8 of those patients went to the operating room. 6 of them were found to have bowel injuries. So I just don't think that our exam or our selective approach is effective enough for this particular patient. And I think we should pursue a whole body CT.
So with all that's been presented here, there are a lot of reasons that you could decide to do a PAN scan or not. These are some of the reasons that are often touted, all right? The important thing, again, we're going to drive home with all of these trauma conferences and within the trauma bay, this depends on good communication and teamwork. Everyone in the trauma bay wants what's best for the patient, all right? We may be thinking about it in different ways, but everyone in that room wants what's best for the patient. If you disagree, it should be based on what's best for the patient, all right? One of the things that's not on here is age. Age will often help you in your decision whether or not to PAN scan. You notice none of these studies were in children. These are all adult studies that have been presented. So a younger age might make you less likely to PAN scan. An older age might make you more likely to PAN scan.
You might be more likely to PAN scan if you have an unreliable exam. You've got someone with chronic pain and you can't differentiate where their injuries are. They're anticoagulated, they're intoxicated, they're unaccessible. Maybe you have a high acuity shift. The emergency department is blowing up, or the emergency department is fine, but trauma is in the operating room with a very sick patient. They are scattered all over the hospital. Those of you who have been on trauma know that's true. And we need to ensure that we don't miss anything. We do this in the emergency department all the time, where we'll order tests before we see the patient, just based off of their complaint. And we call that efficiency. So if you have a high acuity shift, it's less funny than you might think it is, if you really think about it. If you have a high acuity shift, that might be a reason to do that. Maybe you've got someone who's unreliable, and perhaps you just have a can't miss philosophy. When I see these patients, I cannot miss anything. I have to find everything. Put that in contrast to some of the other reasons why you might not want to. Concerns about radiation exposure, an increased ED length of stay when we find some of the incidentalomas and we're waiting for multiple services to come and consult on these patients, which will prolong their ED stay. The diagnostic momentum of we're going to get a head CT, so we might as well get a neck. And if we're going to get a C-spine, we might as well get the TNL. And while we're getting a TNL, we'll just do the chest and abdomen and pelvis. And that diagnostic momentum can sometimes continue throughout. The trust in clinical decision instruments. This patient has very low risk by name your clinical decision instrument you want to use. There's concerns of cost. And there is, as Dr. Nelson alluded to, the potential for a don't find everything pathology. Some things you don't want to find. If you want to find that questionable subacute transverse process fracture, or a mild wedge deformity that is age indeterminate, is that going to prolong that patient's stay, their consults, all of these other things? These are considerations that are worth discussing as you determine which way you want to go. And I'm going to let Dr. Nelson and Dr. Pacheco finish out with their summary slides, and then we'll take comments and questions from the audience.
All right, so we've tried to illustrate some of the pros and cons for whole body CT in trauma patients. Some of the pros that Dr. Pacheco talked about and did a very good job at is that CT is fast, very sensitive for injury, reduces time to diagnosis, and probably finds a lot of injuries that you wouldn't otherwise find. I, on the other hand, have talked about some of the drawbacks or some of the potential drawbacks, right? So we've talked about cost, and there's evidence perhaps that whole body CT really isn't all that more expensive. Radiation, there is a real but small risk on an individual level, but nevertheless, it's something to be considered. And then incidental findings, where we really don't know what the clinical significance of this is, other than that it creates a lot of cost and headache for patients. However, I will say that some of the while these drawbacks are considerations, I'd argue they are all often outweighed by the need to obtain a rapid diagnosis in a patient with potentially life-threatening imaging. And REACT 2 certainly demonstrated that whole body CT is very good at doing that with shorter times in the ED and shorter times to diagnosis. Additionally, like Dr. Lee said, there are many other patient and system factors that we need to consider. The reliability of a patient's exam, their mental status, are they on blood thinners? How busy is the trauma bay? And how likely is it that we are actually going to be able to observe this patient? So back to our initial question, when should you get a PAN scan? So there are numerous published protocols about when a PAN scan should be obtained. All of them seem to incorporate some very core elements. Number one, alteration in a patient's hemodynamic status. Number two, suspicion of critical injuries. Number three, severe mechanism of injury. And four, abnormal mental status, which are essentially the inclusion criteria that REACT 2 used, but which I've listed here. But this list certainly isn't complete. And I could think of limitless other concerning mechanisms that would probably warrant whole body CT, like explosions, motorcycle, bike crashes, pedestrian struck, high-speed MVC, rollovers, found down. You have no idea what happened, right? And in the end, I don't think we necessarily have a data-driven answer for when to PAN scan in every instance. And it's important to realize that judgment and experience play a big part here, okay? And by the way, in real life, all of these patients are the PAN scan. Some of them twice. So say you aren't doing a whole body CT though and have decided to perform selective scanning. How is this done? Okay. How to do selective scanning is a whole different talk, right? Maybe a good one for our next conference. But in essence, you're scanning based on a suspicion for injury. There's a number of tools, like Dr. Pacheco was saying, for assistance in making these decisions, such as Nexus for C-spine imaging and PCARM for pediatric head injuries. And while these can be helpful, it's also important to realize that they all have their limitations. For example, Nexus you can't use on elderly people. It's just not validated for elderly people.
But last week we talked about recognizing our own biases. And I think in the heat of the moment when high acuity, it's one of the times where you have to be aware of what you're biased. And I was very biased that certainly I'm a good enough doctor that I can find when there's something wrong in a trauma patient. So why hand scan? And I have been proven wrong. So consider some of that. I still may not pan scan everyone, but some of the literature presented is actually pretty striking. So what I would encourage you to do is discuss whether or not to pan scan and not necessarily be as rigid as maybe I was about whether or not to pan scan. It's an all or nothing. There's a discussion that could be had for all of these, okay? So consider that on your next shift. I really want you to give a round of applause for Dr. Pacheco and Dr. Nelson. They were